facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, it's so good to be with you today. It's Tuesday, October the 11th. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, and you can call in right now to talk to me. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. 888-914-9149. You can also email the show, as always, cale@relevantradio.com. C-A-L-E, Clark, well, that's later. I got confused there. The email address is cale@relevantradio.com. And my Twitter account, that's the one I was thinking about, is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account on Twitter is at Cale Clark Show. My thanks to Brooke Taylor for sitting in for me yesterday. Did such a great job, and thank you, Brooke. Yesterday was Canadian Thanksgiving, so I had to partake. I was with family and spent the day. And by the way, I double dip on Thanksgiving. I do the U.S. Thanksgiving as well. Why not? More turkey is never a bad thing. Tryptophan, right? Gives you a good nap afterwards. But I always feel like the American Thanksgiving is a little bit too close to Christmas. I kind of like how the Canadian one's in October, so it kind of spreads things out a little bit. But like I said, I double dip. And if you want to dip onto the phone lines right now and give me a call, 888-914-9149 once again is that number. And today's a pretty momentous day because today is the 60th anniversary of the inaugural session of the Second Vatican Council. It's also the feast day of St. John Paul II, or not St. John Paul II, sorry, St. John the 23rd, Pope St. John the 23rd. Man, I'm totally discombobulated today. I'm still asleep from the turkey yesterday. But having said that, yeah, it's a great feast day, and I'm going to be sharing with you actually a little bit later some info on the question of whether or not John the 23rd was actually incorrupt. This has been a bone of contention among some people. And in fact, apparently in Rome today, his mortal remains were displayed apparently near the high altar at St. Peter's. It kind of moved them from their normal location. And I did see them when I was in Rome several years ago. And anyways, just to let you know, Pope Francis, now it's midnight right now, about midnight in Rome. But earlier this evening, in a special evening mass, Pope Francis, of course, celebrated a special mass in commemoration not only of the feast day of St. John the 23rd, but the opening of the Second Vatican Council. And he preached a rather fiery homily, apparently. And I didn't hear his remarks directly, but I did read a little piece in the Washington Post about this, and they'd quoted Pope Francis on it. And he talked about the ideological battles that have sort of ensued in the church since Vatican II between quote-unquote liberals and quote-unquote conservatives. And I always hate applying political categories to when it comes to doctrine, because basically you're either Orthodox or you're a heretic. liberals and conservatives, we can keep those for politics, but you know what I'm talking about when I say this. And so here's some quotes from Pope Francis today. In his homily, he apparently blamed the temptation to choose sides in these ideological battles on the, quote, on the devil who wants to sow the scandal of division, end of quote. And he's certainly right about that. That's the devil's game, divide and conquer. He did that with Adam and Eve, kind of separated the two. He was able to kind of make his attack there, divide and conquer. Disunity is always a big theme in his. And so here's another quote from Pope Francis today. He said, quote, how many times in the wake of the council did Christians prefer to choose sides in the church, not realizing that they were breaking their mother's heart? He asked, to be on the right or the left rather than with Jesus, to present themselves as, quote, guardians of the truth or, quote, pioneers of innovation, rather than seeing themselves as humble and grateful children of Holy Mother Church. He said, quote, let us overcome all polarization and preserve our communion, end of quote. All right, so there is no doubt there's still a lot of confusion, a lot of disunity in the church stemming from Vatican II. And no matter where you stand on this, it's an issue. It's something that we have to talk about. And some people even want to say that Vatican II was not a good thing at all. And it's I read a really interesting piece by Larry Chapp, the theologian Larry Chapp. He's a great chap, that guy. And he wrote about that. He actually said that, hey, I'm going to give you a take on this that maybe you really haven't heard before or haven't heard lately. He actually thinks that Vatican II was a great success. Well, how can he say that in light of the battles that are going on, the liturgical wars that are out there? What was, you know, Mass in the vernacular, the common language of the people? Is that a good thing, or should it have stayed with the traditional Latin Mass? Has Vatican II spawned a lot of too many problems, more than it was worth? The quote-unquote spirit of Vatican II, which has been in the news lately, this quote-unquote spirit of Vatican II, which is always detached from its official documents. I remember when Pope Benedict was elected as Pope, there was a guy in my parish by the name of Marty, and I was really excited because I was a big fan of Cardinal Ratzinger, and I was actually hoping that he would be elected, and a lot of people didn't think it was going to happen, but it did, so I was like, yes, and came to Mass, and I was so excited about it the next time after the conclave had chosen him. And this guy, Marty, I was sort of expressing how happy I was, and he said, no, this is a total disaster. And I said, what are you talking about? And Marty said, this guy, Pope Benedict, is going to tear down everything that Vatican II stood for, the spirit of Vatican II. And I'm like, okay, what documents of Vatican II did you have in mind that are going to be, you know, torn up here? And don't forget that he was there. He was actually one of the fathers of Vatican II. He's one of the Council Fathers, as was Karol Wojtyła, who became John Paul II. And there's no question that St. JP II and Pope Benedict after him, they really made it their mission, I think, as popes, to give the authentic interpretation of Vatican II. And I think in the various encyclicals of John Paul II, starting with the one on Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of Man, which is his first one, he wanted to give sort of the authentic take on Vatican II and kind of clear up a lot of the confusion, because he was there. Pope Benedict was there. Now, as you'll see, maybe being there isn't all it's cracked up to be. I'll talk about that in just a second, but they knew what was going on. They knew what it was really about. And some people, of course, did attempt to hijack the church using the quote-unquote spirit of Vatican II, which, again, doesn't have a whole lot to do with what was actually written in the documents. But I think it's a good idea for all of us to try to read this stuff. It's going to take some time. It's going to take maybe centuries for this to all shake down. So anyways, here's what Larry Chapp said. And he was writing for our Sunday Visitor on their website. And the title of his piece was 60 Years After the Opening of the Second Vatican Council, Where Do We Stand? And I'll put a link to this, by the way. I'll get producer Jim to put a link to this in the show notes so you can read it yourself later. But I just want to give some quotes from this piece. He sort of lays out, before he says the council was actually a smashing success, he lays out the cynical view of Vatican II, and you might recognize this. He says, quote, the question of the council's legacy is an ongoing matter of continuing debate among theologians whose discussions of the finer theological points of the council leave most average Catholics yawning. Ooh, maybe a fair point. He says, quote, the relationship between nature and grace, what is that? Neo-scholasticism versus more modern theologies? Don't really understand theology anyway, so who cares? Religious freedom for all and civil society? Duh, isn't that a no-brainer? He's obviously going, this is what the average person out there thinks of these issues, whether he's right or wrong about this. I think he's probably on point here. Here's another thought that's out there. This is from the council too. This concept, the council really enunciated this in a more clear fashion, but non-Catholics have a legit shot at salvation, while the average guy in the street says, well, of course they do. Mass in the vernacular in a reformed liturgy, is that still a question for anyone? other than a small group of right-wing Latin fanatics over at that abandoned parish downtown? End of quote. All right, now, I don't think it's that bad. I think a lot of people are into the Latin Mass for sure. I don't think they're all just... And maybe some communities are smaller, but it's not that small. Anyways, he goes on to say, local bishops now have more independent authority from the Pope than they did before. Really? Seems the Pope is still the celebrity center of attention, with the Catholic media reporting on the Pope's every hiccup and facial twitch. End of quote. All right, so that's sort of his take, Larry Chapp's take on what the average person in the pew, maybe Joe Sixpack, thinks of Vatican II. And maybe he's bang on with that assessment. So here's another question that he brings up. And maybe you've heard people talking this way, or maybe you've had these thoughts. He says, the deeper question beyond all of the ongoing theological debates is why an average Catholic in the pew should continue to care about the council at all, since it seems now to be in our rearview mirrors as your grandfather's council, lacking any real existential grip on the day-to-day concerns of average people. End of quote. So he says, to a lot of people, he's basically saying to a lot of people, the 1960s seems like ancient history. Maybe not to everybody. I mean, lots of people were born way before the 1960s who are still operational right now. But to a certain generation, it seems like a distant time in the midst of the past. People think about, and he talks about people thinking about the 60s in connection with hippies, drugs, Vietnam, the Beatles. Don't tell Patrick Madrid the Beatles are a relic of history. He'll never speak to you again. So a lot of people, he thinks, are completely indifferent to the whole time period. They think it's a relic of the past. In fact, as Larry Crabb notes, some people even think that we should have a third Vatican Council, a Vatican III. Well, by the way, why can we go back to other names? I guess it's where it takes place, like Constantinople and anyways. So I guess it has to be Vatican III, the next one. It's probably going to be at the Vatican. So a lot of people think we do need a Vatican III to take up even more contemporary concerns. He talks about traditional Catholics who blame the council for all of the modern woes of the church. They think the council is a complete failure. There are a bunch of liberal Catholics in the church who also think that it's a failure and that we should just move on from the council and embrace the progressive agenda of secular society, especially when it comes to matters of sexual morality. Now, I think he's right on about all these points. There are people out there who do think along these lines. He also thinks that some people are exhausted from talking about this. So he calls it a spiritual exhaustion concerning the council that breeds frustration. And he says there's another group out there who think that why are we even talking about this when we should be focused on other maybe more pressing problems in the church rather than what's the proper interpretation of Vatican II. Why is it that there are so few religious vocations? Why are people walking away from the church in record numbers? In fact, that's true. For every one person who is baptized in the Catholic Church, there are about seven people who walk out the door, according to the latest stats from the Pew Research Group. Why are so many parishes closing? Why are so many schools closing? I just heard today, actually, that the Diocese of Steubenville, Ohio, home to the famous Franciscan University of Steubenville, apparently they're planning on merging with a neighboring diocese because there's just not enough to go around. And a lot of people think, as Chapp points out, it's a lot like Nero fiddling as Rome burned. You know, where people are worried about the finer points of the teachings of the council, when there are much more pressing issues going on in the faith today. The main question is, why should people still believe at all? And maybe he's right about that. Maybe he's right about that. So that's sort of the negative view, if you will, of Vatican II and the council that's out there. Some of the negative views about it. But he says, Larry Chapp says, there's actually another way to look at the Second Vatican Council, which is as pretty much a success And we'll get into that in just a second. Let's go to the phones right now. John is calling from somewhere in the suburbs of Chicago. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you? Thanks
I'm
for taking
great.
My call. Love
you got
the radio.
It.
God bless you guys. So a great topic. I'm just looking at it pragmatically. How are we doing? Look at the numbers. I mean, you can just line up whatever lens you want to look at. Mm-hmm. Most often when I talk and we hear people talk, it's always an opinion.
Yeah.
No one's talking about, you just did. You just enumerated a bunch of facts, which are really, I think, important. One can't deny the fact that 50% of people get divorced today, that parishes are closing. We had a huge scandal in our church. Religious orders are trying to find a way to stay open in the 60s and probably early 70s, 73, 74. Mm-hmm. Religious orders went south. They used to have tons of religious going in, and now they're trying the best they can to stay afloat. Those that have money can. So how does one look at it and go, oh, we're doing a really good job here? I'm just baffled. And I don't know how, what is one looking at going, and think about it, you can't blame the council because was it really the best time to do it when the world was coming to an end in the 60s? Everything was hitting the fan,
like
furthermore, were they really cognizant that you had a media that was just blossoming? So it really didn't matter what they did. What mattered was is what they printed and it was put out and how they interpreted it.
Yeah, that's a great point. That the John, thank you so much for that call. That's a great point that. The council sort of happened at the cusp of the age of the mass media, pre-internet. Imagine if the council happened today. Man, there'd be Twitter would be the tweets from Vatican III would be unbelievable. Break the internet, probably all the inside scoops that we would get and rumors and innuendo. And so, I guess we can be thankful for that it was pre-internet revolution. But the age of mass media, obviously. Newspapers, magazines were talking about it all over the world, television as well. It was a huge, huge event and really an epoch-making event. But is there a positive side to this? There are a lot of people out there, both Orthodox, unorthodox, a lot of voices out there that say it was a disaster, no matter what perspective you're coming from. But is there another way to look at this? We're going to talk about this after the break. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. We will be right back. The Relevant Radio Studio line is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Flexible Premium Life Insurance. For less than $12 a month, a 40-year-old can get $500,000 of coverage. Go to relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Explaining the Catholic faith and how you can live it and share it too. It's the Cale Clark Show. Have a question? Give Cale a call at 888-914-9149.
Yeah, thank you so much for tuning in to the Cale Clark Show. Yes, that number is 888-914-9149. We're going to talk about the fact that today is the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Second Vatican Council. Going through some thoughts from theologian Larry Chapp about how he actually says that in spite of all the craziness that's out there and a lot of the controversies that we've all been aware of throughout the years with respect to Vatican II, ultimately the council is a success. We'll get into why he says that in just a moment. I'm going to go to the phones right now. Randy is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Randy.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for calling in.
Oh, I'm just jumping out of my seat. I listened to the words you wrote or said of what Pope Francis said today. And I've been waiting for years now through the pandemic and everything for the words to come from our leaders, political leaders too, but let's focus on our church leaders as shepherds And just this whole idea of let go of all of these petty personal conservative Republican. I've been frustrated with, I won't name them, but some leading church magazines where you read it and you think, my gosh, these aren't brothers and sisters. These are enemies. And their vitriol is so loud and great. And I would love to hear not only the Pope now, but the bishops and the priests. I think we need to hear this over and over and over and over again, that we are one, and it's our unity is where we're strong. Sure, you can have disputes, talk about it, seek first to understand the other maybe, but we gotta, I just loved hearing you say those words. I've been waiting for it for several years now as I've watched us just attack each other. And it's just so wrong to me. It's not Christian.
Yeah, well, Randy, thank you so much for your call and for saying that. And yeah, Pope Francis was very clear on that, you know, the enemy, Satan himself, is the cause of disunity in the church and also in the world too, to a large extent. And so I do think we do have to recapture that, and it's a stumbling block. It's a scandal. Let's say you're a secular person who's thinking about Christianity. You think, man, these guys can't even agree with one another. There are, of course, all kinds of divisions within Christianity. But even within the Catholic Church, there is obviously a wing that tries to break away from the established teaching of the Church on faith and morals, and others who try to defend it. And so, yeah, we got to get back on track with the one faith, one Lord, one baptism, as St. Paul talks about in his letter to the Ephesians. There's no question about that. So, Randy, thank you very much for that call. Really appreciate that encouragement. Was the council actually successful? Well, Larry Chapp says yes. He says yes. And that's born of looking at it through the lens of history and having a bit of a wide-angle lens on this thing. And so he actually says this in his piece, and we're going to put a link to this in the show notes once again. He says, quote, "In my view, the council has been a victim here of its own success." Yes, you heard that right. The council was, contrary to the reigning narrative, a success and not a failure. There's a sad tendency these days to focus on all the turmoil that happened in the wake of the council and to use that turmoil as the primary metric for assessing the success of the conciliar project. But I think this is a deeply problematic way of assessing the council and is flawed on multiple levels, end of quote. And then he starts talking about how, historically speaking, just about every major council in church history has had this period, and sometimes a very long period, of strife, division, misunderstanding, issues, problems following in its wake. So he talks about, of course, maybe the most famous of the early church councils, the first, the Council of Jerusalem was the first council, but he calls the first ecumenical council the Council of Nicaea, which happened in 325 AD. And that was kind of pulled together by the new convert, Constantine, who had recently converted to the faith, and it was really convoked to deal with the Arian heresy. Now, the Nicene Creed, which we say every Sunday, big feast days as well, there's a huge section in the middle of that creed about the divinity of Christ, the fact that Christ is God. And the reason why that's there is because they're fighting against, a lot of people don't even know who this is, but maybe the worst heretic in the history of the church, Arius, this renegade priest, who basically started running around saying that Jesus isn't God. He's a creature. He's the first and maybe greatest creature, but he is a creature. That's what Arius said. That's a heresy. But it was really, really powerful, really, really popular. And as Larry Chapp explains, we all know this, at one point, over half of the bishops in the Catholic Church actually were Arian. They believed in this heresy. That's incredible to think about. How did the church survive? It could only be through the Holy Spirit. It could only be the divine origin of the church that could sustain this body in light of this incredible rupture. And so it was a really popular heresy at the time because Chapp explains it fit really well into the quote-unquote spirit of the times. And this had to do with philosophical currents, theological currents that were going on at the time. The clergy loved it. It was really popular among the clergy because of the fact that it kind of fit with the cultural zeitgeist. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? But of course, the Council Fathers condemned Arianism as a heresy and confirmed the fact that Jesus is consubstantial with the Father, which means basically they're both made up of the same stuff, which is divinity. Okay, so that's the basis of the Nicene Creed. And Chap goes on to say, well, just because they settled that theological debate definitively with the council definitions, that doesn't mean that the problems were all over, because a lot of bishops didn't accept the results of the council. They said, no, we don't buy it. Even secular authorities in Rome didn't accept what the church taught about this. And so, and I mentioned this guy recently on the Cale Clark Show. I did a whole show on St. Athanasius, who was one of the great heroes in church history, who so powerfully fought against Arianism, this teaching that Jesus is not God. He fought against it, and he was exiled. He was persecuted relentlessly. People were hunting for his life. And that the famous story about Athanasius, he was being chased by some guys. He's in a boat. He's in the front of the boat. He's wearing a hoodie. Nobody can see his face. And these guys pull up alongside in this other boat, and they say, have you seen Athanasius? We're looking for him. And he's like, yes, I have seen him. And if you go just a little bit faster, you'll pass him really soon. Thanks so much. And then they take off. And of course, they go by him. He is Athanasius. And I think that's really funny. But he was hunted his whole life for defending the divinity of Christ. Larry Chap brings up St. Maximus the Confessor, who lived around the year AD 580 to 662. Now, this is centuries after the Council of Nicaea, hundreds of years. This guy was persecuted again and again and again for defending what the council taught about Jesus Christ. In fact, he was actually, St. Maximus the Confessor was himself put on trial for heresy in Constantinople. His tongue was cut out. His right hand was cut off, and that's the hand he used to write with. So it was really cruel. And they did that, obviously, to shut him up, that he would not continue to preach and teach the Orthodox faith. And of course, very shortly afterwards, he passed away. So Larry Chap says, quote, compared to such turmoil and persecutions, the conciliar mayhem after Vatican II looks positively pale and tame. In comparison, it is therefore laughable from a strictly historical perspective that a mere 60 years of controversy and debate should be used as an argument against the success of Vatican II. Yeah, so historically, 60 years is nothing. He goes on to say, furthermore, we see that the post-conciliar chaos was caused by the exact same social forces that caused the problems after the Council of Nicaea. Namely, there's many in the church who want the church to conform to the cultural and moral norms of the current culture, as well as the philosophical ideologies that animate that culture. It's a story as old as the church herself, as we see in the letters of St. Paul, as he struggled to get his congregations to stop thinking like Roman pagans and trying to simply fit Christ into that matrix, end of quote. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. So 60 years of misunderstandings, that's nothing. That's a drop in the bucket. This goes back to the very beginning of the faith. And so that's an interesting take by Larry Chap. We've got to have some perspective on this. And so he says, hey, don't get tired over this. Don't throw in the towel. Vatican II, he says, it's the most important Catholic event of modern times, despite the disagreements over its meaning and our fatigue over those disagreements. We must not allow ourselves to succumb to the temptation of weariness that causes our devotion to its message to wane. What if Athanasius or Maximus the Confessor had thought that way? What if they'd given up the cause? Well, the church would have suffered even greater indignities and distortions, and it would have taken even more centuries than it already did for it to be sorted out. And so in the same way, he's saying we can't abandon Vatican II. We can't just say, we wish it never happened, because that's not the solution. It did happen. Its message is crucial. JP II fought for it. Pope Benedict has fought for it. So we have to as well really get the message and incorporate it. Not the distortions of the message, not the caricatures of the council, but what it actually taught. What it actually taught. Here's one thing. Here's one thing that he mentions in his article. He says he has a lot of, Larry Chapp is a theologian, and he's a lay person, and he knows a lot of other lay theologians who constantly write to him, they constantly email him, complaining, moaning, and groaning about Vatican II, and they wish it never happened. They want to go back to the way it was before. And Larry Chapp says, the irony of them doing this is that they wouldn't even be theologians if it wasn't for Vatican II, because lay theologians were not a thing back then. Lay people really couldn't get into that profession or be a professional theologian. And thank God that people can do this, because I think the church has benefited from the richness of different perspectives. But back then, before Vatican II, most theologians were either bishops, priests, religious maybe, but it was not at all the domain of lay people. You just wouldn't see that. So the very fact that they can even become theologians is a testament to the success, at least at that level, of Vatican II. And they think that the whole council was a failure. So how ironic is that? That's a pretty good point by Larry Chapp. But there's actually a much bigger point that we need to get out of Vatican II. But we're going to take some phone calls right now. We got to get back to the phone lines, because calls are filling up here. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Let's go to Father Joe. Welcome back to the show, Father Joe, in Bayhead, New Jersey. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm glad to join in the conversation. I grew up with Vatican II. I had just started to serve masses in Latin, and then Vatican II came along, so we quickly switched to English. And I loved John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, and all the interesting things that were brand new that were coming out, and to have the mass in vernacular was really, I really then began to love the mass more. And so when I finally got to seminary after another career for a few years, I really appreciated the biblical scholarship. And I know it's grown. I mean, it was very, you had the bean counters trying to figure out what were the authentic words of Jesus. And I think we got through that necessary, painful step in the growth of biblical scholarship. But I think it was an important phase. But I love the idea of the people of God, and that lay people participate more in the liturgy. So I'm pretty much very positive about Vatican II. And if we're going to go back to a language, I think especially in the United States, we wouldn't be going to Latin, we'd be going to Spanish.
Father Joe, thank you very much for your call, and thank you for those points. And by the way, when Father Joe was mentioning bean counters, he really did mean that literally. What he's referring to there is a group of scholars that, especially in the 1990s, they really got into the media. They were on the cover of Time Magazine, Newsweek. It was called the Jesus Seminar. And these were a group of, they're pretty radically liberal scholars that would actually try to take apart the Gospels, and they would vote on whether the sayings of Jesus in the Gospels were legit, whether he actually said them or not. So they would, you probably heard of the red letter editions of the Bible or the New Testament, where the words of Jesus are in red letters. Well, what they would do is they'd vote with a red bead if they thought that he really did say it, and they would vote with a pink bead if maybe he said it, a gray bead, pretty doubtful, and a black bead would be, no, the church totally made that up. Jesus never said that. Well, one thing you should realize is that these guys got in the media a lot in North America, but in Europe, they were basically laughed at. They were laughed at, the Jesus Seminar. Most scholars didn't take them seriously at all, but they were media darlings, right? Because it was news, quote unquote. That's why they were in Newsweek magazine, because, hey, the church made up the sayings of Jesus. That's news. Yeah, if you come on there and say, yeah, I believe the Gospels are trustworthy and accurately reflect the teaching of Jesus, you're not going to get on the news. So you always have to have a healthy dose of skepticism when it comes to all that stuff. And let's go to another call. Let's go to Brent in Baltimore on line 2. Hi, Brent.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, so my question was, I'm not challenging on whether Vatican II was a success or not, but it, if we can talk about the belief in the Eucharist has declined and the church attendance has declined. Now, I'm a convert. I'm married. I have eight children. I don't question. I just want to let you know where I'm coming from. And can we discuss those two metrics?
Belief in the Eucharist and church attendance. Why are they in decline? I think it's probably a multifaceted answer, Brent. I think it's a lot of it has to do with the failure of catechesis. I think. And Chap actually talks about this a little bit in his article. The idea that we've been feeding people, and he didn't say it quite like this, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but we've been feeding people spiritual pablum for a long time. And I think, and that's one of the things I like about Relevant Radio, working with Relevant Radio, is that we're able to talk about some things that kind of challenge people, challenge them to go a little bit deeper. And I try to do that a little bit more on the Faith Explained show that I host, where we go into Scripture. And it's important for people to know Scripture. It's important for people to ask good questions about it and not sort of be content with the sort of felt, images of Noah's Ark and stuff like that that you would see in Sunday school. You can't have a five-year-old understanding of the Bible as an adult and expect to keep your faith in the secular world or of the catechism. Most people, unfortunately, their Catholic education stops when they're confirmed, when they're maybe 13 years old or 12 or whatever the case may be. The age is different depending on where you go. Well, a 12-year-old understanding of the faith, but then they continue on in other areas of their life, their profession, relationships, politics, finance, science, and they get an adult education in all those other areas, but their faith formation kind of stops in the eighth grade. That can't be the case. It simply can't be the case. But I think a lot of it has to do with a failure of catechesis. I think. I mean, that's not the entire answer. There's a lot of other things at play as well. But I think that's part of it. I don't know if that's a fair answer to your question, Brent. But what do you think, Brent? What do you think are some of the reasons why Eucharistic belief and church attendance have dropped?
I don't have the answer. For me, I was a former Methodist, and I was drawn to the teachings of the Catholic Church, especially natural family planning, which I was introduced in a university setting. I'm a physician. And so the teachings, the moral teachings, were very important to me. And as well, the Eucharist really drew me that I could receive the body and blood, soul and divinity of our dearly beloved Lord every day if I wanted to.
Yeah.
And so I'm involved with men's groups in our church. I'm involved in catechesis. And my wife's involved. I acknowledge that it's a secular world. We're really fighting a lot of unusual things out in society. And it's not clear to me how we evangelize in a world with logic that operates with postmodernism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where that's, one person would say, well, question. That's your truth.
Yeah.
That's your truth. Well, that doesn't make sense. There's absolute truth.
Yeah, that's a great example of sort of the philosophical undercurrents that are in culture right now. Postmodern relativism, this concept that there is no truth. And obviously, Pope Benedict very famously said, we live in a dictatorship of relativism in which you have to be a relativist or else we're going to persecute you. But this whole concept, this whole statement, there is no such thing as absolute truth. That in itself is a truth statement. People who believe that think it's true. So we really can't get away from this. But and this is another thing too, like proposing that there is such a thing as truth. That's something that the modern mind really doesn't like to hear. What the secular mind really doesn't like to hear. But we have to keep saying this time and time. And truth obviously is a person. Ultimately, the person of Jesus Christ, who says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." But it's true that a lot of people don't want to hear these syllogisms. They do like to see it lived out personally before them. So what you're doing, Brent, with your family and your medical practice, no doubt, being witness to the faith, that just being a joyful Catholic who enjoys their faith, and people can see that, they can sense that lived out before them. And I think it was Pope Paul VI who closed off the Second Vatican Council, John the 23rd passed away before it was over, who said that the world will not listen to teachers, but they will listen to witnesses, and we need more of that. And the witness eventually has to teach too, because the person's going to say, why are you like this? And you have to give them an answer. What's the secret of your joy? We have to be able to tell them. So we will have to use words at some point. That's why it's really important to know our faith well. So it's an important conversation to be had for sure, Brent. So thank you so much for that call. Brent, I guess Dr. Brent from Baltimore calling in. And you can call in too, 888-914-9149. We're up against a break right now, but we'll be back with much more on the Cale Clark Show right after this. The Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio's line, is hiring today. Several positions are available throughout the United States. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with Catholic Order of Foresters, an Illinois Life Insurance Society, not licensed in all states. Hey, welcome back to the Cale Clark Show. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Having a good time discussing the 60th anniversary of Vatican II, and your takes on this, your hot takes on this are coming in. 888-914-9149. I'm going to get back to the phones in just one second, but I want to mention to you that Advent is coming up very, very quickly, and you only have a few days left to get in on a really great chance to win something amazing. You can celebrate the Christmas season this year with a beautiful nativity set. In fact, Relevant Radio, we are giving away 200 of these beautiful nativity sets. A very generous donor has made them available to us. They're gorgeous. They're hand-painted. You can put them on your porch. You can put them in your front bay window, your front yards, wherever, and display the true, humble, and profound reason for the season. But you only have a few days left to enter. You have until midnight Central Time, October the 16th, to sign up. That's it. And then it's over. So we have 200 to give away. Hopefully one will have your name on it. You can proudly welcome Christ into your heart and home this year in a special way by signing up to win at relevantradio.com/set. Once again, you can go to relevantradio.com/set for a chance to win one of these beautiful nativity sets. So now that that's out of the way, we can once again get back to. And again, we put this in the show notes, so you can, when the podcast is up, just a few minutes after the show, you'll be able to, if you miss part of this discussion, you can get in on this. We're talking about Vatican II and theologian Larry Chapp. And by the way, yesterday I was out for Canadian Thanksgiving, but Larry Chapp was actually on the Drew Mariani show yesterday on hour number two. So you can check the podcast for that show if you want to hear Mr. Chapp live in the flesh. I don't know if he talked about this or not, but this was an article that he wrote basically saying that Vatican II was a success. Yes, there have been problems. Yes, there have been misunderstandings. This happens with all church councils. Sometimes it takes centuries to get all this sorted out. There are a lot of great things that came out of Vatican II, and one of the greatest emphases, and maybe this is the key message of Vatican II, if you want to say, what was Vatican II about? It's about a lot of different things, but the main point was, I think, this: the universal call to holiness, that everyone, every baptized person is called, and every person is called to be baptized. And then every baptized person is called to become a saint and to help others to do so as well. That's the bottom line, the universal call to holiness. There was this sort of clericalism that infected the church for centuries. It's still out there today, vestiges of it, of course, that only priests can be holy, only the religious can be holy. Only this is the domain of the clergy and religious, and everybody else is just trying to get through life and somehow make it into heaven by the skin of their teeth. Well, It's a pretty poor way of looking at the Catholic faith. No, we're all called to the heights of holiness. We're called to be canonizable saints. And so one of the things Chapp points out in his article is a very famous quote. There's a Latin version of this. You know, we talked a lot about the Latin Mass. There's a Latin version of this quote. But in English, it's, you can't give away what you don't have. You can't give what you don't have. And if you want to give away the gospel, you have to be possessing it. You have to be living it out. And so Vatican II talked about opening up the windows of the church to the modern world, But unfortunately, this message of the universal call to holiness got kind of lost in the breeze at some level. Now, Chap says it like this. He says, quote, "This call to go out into the world with the gospel morphed instead into a church that allowed the culture to blow in like a hurricane. The message that you can find holiness even in doing ordinary things was then transformed into its opposite, namely that it is holy to be ordinary." Okay, let me say that again in case you didn't catch that. "The message that you can find holiness even in doing ordinary things was transformed into its opposite, that it is holy to be ordinary." Chap says, after that happened, the rout was on, the bottom fell out of this most central of council ambitions. We can debate forever why this happened, and that's an important debate to have, but one thing is certain, the council as such was not the cause of this, but its victim. And I make that claim with full knowledge of those who think the opposite. End of quote. I think that's a really, really good point. The church, by and large, has not done a great job of communicating this, getting this message out there, and helping people to live it. In fact, St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, he was preaching this universal call to holiness. And he didn't invent this either. This is as old as the gospel, he said. It's as old as the gospel and as forever new. But when he was preaching this stuff in Spain in the 1920s and 30s, that everyone is called to become a saint, he was considered to be a heretic by some clergy, by some Catholics of his day. Well, he was essentially vindicated in some ways by Vatican II, because that's the central message of Vatican II, the universal call to holiness. And again, this is a gospel message. It's not particular to any saint. But this is one of the places where we're clearly falling down. Let's go back to the phones right now. Dan is calling from Las Vegas. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You know,
I was going to ask you, thank you. I had heard a podcast been a while back. I believe it was on the same council you're talking about where they introduced ecumenism, you know, but this thing that you were just talking about with the Eucharist, I've been wondering about something about that. I wonder if I could go ahead and ask that instead.
Oh, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
The question is, you know, the Bible says you're saved by grace through faith. It's God's power that saves, and it's through your belief that it happens. And so my question is, on the ceremony of the Eucharist, according to the Catholic Church, it changes and becomes the body, the actual body and the blood of Jesus. Now, it doesn't chemically do it. I understand that, but it's in the eyes of God, it's his body and his blood. Does that happen if the person receiving the Eucharist, if the person receiving the Eucharist doesn't believe that it does that, if it's just a glass of wine and a piece of unleavened bread to him and that's it, and he says, "I don't believe," then does it still work for him?
It happens whether or not the person receiving the Eucharist, and you know, hopefully, you if you don't believe that the Eucharist really is Christ, you probably shouldn't be going up there, of course. But it happens independently of whether or not the person, people out there believe that it's happening or not. It either happens or it doesn't, and it does happen by the word of Christ himself. And so the substance, what's there, it's not bread anymore. And you mentioned use the term chemical changes. Well, it's not bread anymore. It's not wine anymore. It actually becomes the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. But only the appearances, or what are called the accidents, you know, which is a technical term, it means it still looks like bread, smells like bread, tastes like bread, but it isn't bread. It's Jesus wearing this disguise, if you will. You know, Halloween's coming up, so you could say that. But yeah, so, and we can get into the reasons for that. We're kind of running out of time here, but this is a reality that happens independently of the belief of people in the pews. This is happening. And we do need to, it's interesting to me that the bishops of the United States have called for a Eucharistic revival. I'm like, right on. This is exactly what we need. We need this. This is so central. And I think if people really did believe in the reality of Christ in the Eucharist, where else would you want to be? Where else would you want to be? And I remember, I think it was Scott Hahn, theologian Scott Hahn, who said before he became Catholic, I mean, if you told him that Jesus was literally right around the corner, Eucharistically, in his local Catholic church, if Catholics really believe this, why aren't people running to their nearest Mass? Why aren't there massive communion lines? It's a good question. So, wow, there's so much to be said here, so much that we could talk about. And tragically, we are out of time for tonight, but we will be back tomorrow. We can pick up this conversation tomorrow. So everybody that's on the line right now, Marge, Noel, Xavier, Dan, Peter, James, I'm so sorry that we are out of time, but please do call back tomorrow. Timory is up next, followed by Father Rocky, the Family Rosary Across America. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Cale Clark Show. Jim produced, Patrick took your phone calls. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.